Welcome to All Analytics Radio. This is Jim Connolly. I'm editor of allanalytics.com. Every business, no matter the industry, has its labor costs, and those expenses can add up. In some cases, they simply get out of hand. A manager can have too many people on one shift, too few on another, or they can lose track of benefit time and end up imposing forced overtime. Poor labor cost management hurts the company and is unfair to the employees as well. Our guest today will provide some insight into how to better manage labor costs using predictive analytics. Lisa Desselkamp is a director with Deloitte, focusing on human resource transformation, and is involved with Deloitte's LaborWise initiative. She advises businesses on best practices in workforce management and refers to wasted labor costs as payroll leakage or labor leakage. Lisa is author of three books on workforce management. There's Workforce Asset Management, Book of Knowledge, and there's No Boundaries, How to Use Time and Labor Management Technology to Win the Race for Profits and Productivity. Those are both from Wiley, as well as Working the Clock from Oakley Press. She joins us today to discuss how predictive analytics can control payroll leakage. Lisa, how are you today?
Hi, Jim. I'm ready for spring. How about you?
Absolutely. We actually have blue skies where I am today. Before we get into the discussion, let me add a note for the listeners. We welcome your questions and comments on the chat board below, and we'll address as many as we can during the next half hour. Then Lisa will join us afterwards for a few minutes to answer more questions and check out your comments. To get the discussion started, I invite listeners to introduce themselves to their peers on the chat board and perhaps share your own thoughts on workforce management issues. So Lisa, let's just get a sense. How severe is labor leakage across industries?
Well, Jim, leakage is a long-standing but hidden problem, which has come into focus as organizations have looked for new ways to reduce cost. It's impacting one of the largest single expenses that most organizations have, and that is the cost of labor. Everybody on the call here today can think about what percentage total labor cost is as a percent of all their costs, and it's usually one of the top three. So what might sound like a small increase in labor leakage can actually have a substantial impact on overall profitability because you're impacting such a large portion of your costs. So if I can reduce the cost of the single largest expense by several percentage points, that's significant. And that's what we're finding, is anywhere from 0.5% to 2.5% of total payroll in this recoverable leakage.
Now, which industries are most susceptible to leakage?
I get that question a lot. Leakage is universal. It happens everywhere. The typical organization with the worst case is going to be an organization with a large hourly workforce. They've got complex pay practices, operations that are beyond 8 to 5. If the organization has grown by acquisition and they've inherited a lot of complexity. And then another one is typically if they're either unionized or operating in a unionized market, so not necessarily in-house, but they're in a competitive labor market and they've added these kinds of complexities, and there's a sense of entitlement, then the organization is more prone to leakage. And it doesn't matter if they have highly skilled workers or even low wage. Now, to be specific, we've helped healthcare, manufacturing, retail, utilities, public sector, you name it, leakage is there. You just have to go look for it.
Could you walk through a couple examples of, how it reveals itself and what some of the causes are?
Well, that's an interesting story because we always knew it was there. For many years of helping employers install these time and attendance systems, we knew that they were taking a very transactional approach to it. And if you spent time with the organization and you spend time in payroll, you know where some of the gaming and gifting is going on. And it gets exposed in analytics when we look at labor data in the right way and we put that labor spending in context. So we look at labor spending differently. So for example, many analysts will immediately go to obvious buckets of labor spending like overtime. But our perspective is overtime is just a symptom. Leakage, as we define it, is shown in the data as anomalies in the data. So anomalies in the hours worked, in punch data, in meal data, in schedule versus actual data. We also look at overcoming the department and job trap. That's where most organizations go when they start to do what they call analysis. But it's really little more than taking a spreadsheet, maybe visualizing. We go to where the problem really happens, by day, by scenario, by the type of person, by the combination of these factors. And we're sort of using these analytic techniques, such as candlesticks and relative position, and we're also creating data, so taking ratios, to expose where the leakage is. So overtime, going back to that example, is just a symptom of a number of things that create unnecessary spending. So overtime is a sort of a ticker, a counter. But you want to understand, how did I get there? How did I get past 40 hours or past 8 hours? And when you look at just something like overtime, it's problematic because it's too simplistic. It isn't actionable. If it were, overtime wouldn't be a problem for so many organizations because so many organizations have already called it out as the problem. But for us, analytics has given us the chance to go, no, that's just a symptom. We can now dig into the real causes.
So that overtime could be caused by either the first shift not producing as much as they should have or accomplishing what they should have, or it could be just caused by a manager not scheduling enough people for second shift. Does that
make
sense?
That's part of it. But what leakage is, one of the core things leakage is time inflation. So when we think about how people report their time, they're basically giving us a purchase order, or they're giving us an invoice for their time. The schedule is a purchase order. Here's what I want you to work. Then the employee comes in and they work, but they might work more than what you had asked for, or more than I needed. And how did they do that? So the leakage is in the ways that they've learned to inflate their time that's not noticed. And in and of itself, it might be a few minutes here and there, but aggregated over time and over large groups of people, it's millions of dollars. So we're looking at how are people inflating time?
Now, from what you described, it sounds like the way people have been operating, you know, if we think of the analytics continuum, you know, they have been operating with descriptive analytics. In other words, here's how many hours of overtime we've had. Here's, you know, what we're paying in vacation time. Now you're talking more about predictive analytics as well. How do you make that leap from descriptive to predictive?
Well, we look at the data and we use it to tell us instead of going in with assumptions about what it is, because descriptive will give you associations of data, and people make the mistake of saying it's a correlation, meaning a cause and effect, when in effect, some of the descriptive analytics really is just associating two things together. You can't really draw a conclusion. Predictive, in our practice, what we've been able to do is take, for example, we took a client's data and we said, let's see if we can predict excessive overtime, and that would be anything over 3%, because that was their average across the organization, but we knew that they had pockets of excessive overtime. So we said, well, what's creating these scenarios where they have that? And we took about 150 different variables just out of timekeeping systems, which might surprise people. We weren't taking other business data. That'll be round two. But in this round of a predictive model, we simply took data out of time and scheduling, and we let the system, by using predictive analytics modeling, tell us what were the factors that closely aligned with overtime. And that gave us, that resulted in about 14 characteristics of a business unit or 14 characteristics about the organization that could predict with a high degree of success what business units would have overtime. interesting.
Now, in that case,
Go ahead. Jim, because it wasn't things that you might expect.
What types of causes were there?
Well, some of the ones that surprised us, size of the department correlated with more overtime, where you might think that the size of the department might give you greater flexibility to flex people around rather than having to have people work overtime. Another was the number of managers, salaried workers. Because why is that? Because they're able to flex their time. They don't contribute to overtime, but their existence can or may not influence how much overtime. Another one that was really surprising was absences, paid time off. You know, this is one of the most frequent excuses a manager gives. I had people who were absent, so people had to fill in. But in fact, with the particular thing that we just finished up with one client, absences actually negatively correlated with overtime. So that really leads us to, well, we need to do more diagnosis around how are they mitigating overtime if indeed they still do have absences.
Now, you just mentioned salaried employees, and you said earlier that, you know, hourly is the most obvious place where you're going to find leakage. What are some of the issues that you find with salaried workforces?
Well, the number one with salaried is they have unreported time off, and that is that they're not what we call positive time capture model. They're not telling you when they arrive and depart, although increasingly organizations are capturing that for a number of business reasons. But because they are not required to punch in and punch out, so to speak, there's a tendency for them to not report their time off, and that becomes a liability on the books. But I think, Jim, the more important or interesting thing that's going to be happening is productivity in the knowledge workforce. That's really going to be the next wave of analytics to explore. The challenge with exempts is that we don't collect enough data about exempt workers, but that's going to be changing because their cost is fixed, but the leakage there is in idle time, non-productive time, operational coverage, like filling in for other hourly workers, and simply doing things that we didn't know they were doing or don't want them to do.
Now, how do you capture that, though?
There are some really interesting technologies out there. That sit. This is assuming, for example, take the most simplistic model, and that's a knowledge worker who spends most of their time working on a computer. Capturing how that time is being spent in terms of how much meeting time, how much time in your core applications that really drive what you do. Where am I most productive? Where am I doing busy work? Where am I idle? What kind of travel time do I have? And then I like to think of it like a Fitbit for your day. And analytics, labor analytics, whether you're hourly, salaried, contract, it gives you sort of that Fitbit so that you can self-monitor and you can also monitor and challenge the organization to get more productive, more careful about their spending.
I think the salaried people in the audience are not going to be encouraging their managers to listen to this broadcast.
Jim. You know, it's a really interesting comment. I just have to share. It's a generational thing. The older folks will say, oh, big brother, and analytics and time reporting and trying to watch what I do. And yet the younger generation is so used to sharing what they do and that data is such a big part of how they operate. And they love the feedback, right? They're wearing the little thing that says how many steps you took today. There's just a changing and evolving mentality about data as a tool for yourself, for your organization. It's not a gotcha. It's let's understand what we're doing and operate better using that information.
Now let me just ask you about, you know, some of the businesses that come to mind. And, you know, when I first saw what you were doing, I thought, okay, retail store and restaurant, you know, can definitely make use of these things. How tough is it to put this type of data into action when we get down to the individual store, the individual restaurant? So the parent company maybe can make good use of this, but the people in those retail type outlets sort of live day to day, in hour to hour. You know, they staff for the rush hour. Do you get resistance from that level?
I wouldn't call it resistance. I think there might be some skepticism at first. And I think the fear is that it's disrupting their current operating model, which is really a gut reaction kind of thing, right? They have a personal art form to how they operate. Rather than having available and rich data in front of them to make decisions, I don't think people don't want that. They don't yet understand how to incorporate it. And they don't want more busy work. You know, they've been jaded. Analytics, the word analytics has been around a long time. And I think a lot of people are jaded because it was misused. And what people were selling was really charts and graphs. And more information is not what people need. They need to be informed and instructed on what's the best decision to make right now. And that's where we see analytics. Analytics has to be in the language of context to their business. It has to say, here's your situation right now, here are your options, and here's the best option in front of you. When you talk about, for example, a retail outlet, and we had a client who had what we call shallow follow-through, which meant at an organizational level, they knew what they needed to do. They had labor standards. They knew what the optimal operating model was. They knew what they needed people to do. But when you got all the way down through the organization at various levels and you got to that store manager, he's not operating according to these principles and labor standards. He's operating in the moment because he's not used to using data. And what we find works is that you channel people to operate inside of an enabling technology, and you educate them that this technology is going to take the burden of the decision-making off of them, or the burden of the data gathering. Let me put it that way. The decision is still theirs. You're not replacing the manager's decision, ultimately, especially with people. It's got to be a human element. And we've seen examples where when it's overly optimized, like scheduling gets highly optimized, that can be a disaster because the system is generating this highly optimized system without regard to what people want to work. Does somebody want to work a two-hour shift because that's all I need them for? Or do I really want to send somebody home who just got here an hour ago? That's probably going to upset them. So when we can balance the needs of the workers and the needs of that manager with an informed set of information in front of him, he's going to enjoy the relief of having to make decisions without good information and insight, and in the fly, in the moment. And the right kind of analytics speaks to him because it's like, yeah, this is telling me my situation exactly. Now here's my list of choices. Okay, and I've got the top three. Now I can make my pick. The other reason that adoption will increase is because it's going to make them more successful in the ways that they're being managed or they're being measured. If they're measured to budget, and this was the problem in these stores, they were over their labor budget, but they were still resistant to the labor model. They didn't have a good way to act on the labor model with information in front of them. It was sort of foreign to them. So giving them the right governance, the right information, the right processes, all that. It's not analytics alone. Analytics is an enabling technology to all those other activities.
Now, could you illustrate let's go back to that local store manager. What do they see or what will they be seeing in the future, perhaps, in terms of how the data comes to them? Is as basic as they fill out their schedule and something flags that says you're overbooking based on your past, your revenue history, or you're underbooking? Is it something as simple as that?
Well, I think those kinds of analysis can exist today where you look at the plan, the budget, and the actual. You may look at point of sale systems or traffic systems that are saying, hey, you know, so many people just walked in the door. It, you know, the sun is shining and it's a sunny day and you're in a, you know, sporting goods store, and we expect higher traffic. Those kinds of things exist today. I think what's going to be new is that it's going to layer on a couple of dimensions when you talk about retail stores. One is cost and cost choices. So who's the lowest cost employee? When I have someone call in sick, for example, retail supervisors are faced with choices every day that are somewhat unpredictable but yet happen over and over. So somebody doesn't show up. I need somebody on the cash register. Who do I call in? Historically, they might call in somebody that's always ready and available to come in, bright and cheerful, but maybe if they call them in too much, they're going to be in overtime. A more informed analytics will say, you know what, we want to share the wealth, and lots of people want hours that work for us, so let's go over to Melissa, who's only been given 10 hours this week. Melissa has told us she wants 15. Let's meet Melissa's expectation on hours this week and give her that shift. There's a whole model we're calling schedule equilibrium. And schedule equilibrium is an advanced way to look at labor scheduling through the lens of the employee, and that, well, the lens of shared values, which is I want to deliver to my employees predictable, stable, and adequate schedules. How do I do that? Well, analytics is going to be the answer to, am I driving and I'm producing these adequate, predictable, and stable schedules? That's going to be very hard to do in your head on a piece of paper. And yet it's really good. It's going to drive retention. It's going to drive engagement, productivity, when people get the kind of schedules that they want.
Now, over the past few years, we've seen more organizations, particularly in the service, you know, customer-facing organizations, dealing with, for instance, on-call employees. And, you know, they never know when they're going to be called in. In some cases, they're not even really compensated for being on call. You know, they obviously have some kind of, they have a bit of a beef there. It sounds like if we apply this type of approach properly, then there's a little more fairness built in for them from what you describe.
I agree. There are some practices that have been instituted over the years to drive both flexibility and coverage in the workplace. You know, on-call dates back to, decades ago when the phone was, you know, tied to the wall and you literally had to stay in the house to hear it ring. And then it became beeper pay. I don't know if you guys remember beepers. And so you had to be at least accessible to a phone, run somewhere and catch a payphone if your beeper went off. And then now we have mobile devices. We have intelligent systems where we can actually see who's available and who has preferences to work now and then. So on-call, in many ways, is very outdated. And it's oftentimes, through our analytics, this has been one of the most interesting areas of analysis, which is the use of on-call relative to how often people are put on-call. In healthcare, for example, on-call is a very popular program so that nurses at any moment have a half a dozen people they can call in. But the data consistently is telling us that the number of times people are actually needed for on-call is very, very small. I've seen the ratio as bad as 300 to 1. So for every 300 times someone is on-call, they only needed one person. A more standard might be 10 or 15 to 1. But even so, that's a pretty rich insurance policy, 15 times more people than I actually need. And the gap is that they're looking at a quick and easy way to staff rather than a more flexible workforce. Maybe I don't need to call anybody in. Maybe I've cross-trained people and I can move someone from one position to another. Maybe I have a float pool. There are cases of retailers, for example, in convenience stores where they actually have float individuals. They're assigned to work that day, but they don't know what location they're going to be working in until they're assigned. So it's not a call-in shift, right? They knew they were working It's just we don't know where the labor will be needed. For example, absenteeism is about 10% any day. So rather than just staffing with the idea that nobody's going to be absent, uh-oh, I've got to call somebody in 10% of the time, organizations are getting smart with analytics using those factors. When am I going to have peaks in absenteeism so that I actually staff to cover it? And that would make on-call go away.
This also lays the groundwork for what, how to approach when trouble hits. And, you know, you have now have to lay off 8-10% of your workforce. You now have the data to actually make solid decisions, as opposed to saying, okay, you know, the last 8% hired or something like that, or the 8% highest salaried, all go. So
but that's a really interesting comment that you bring up, because I'm sure a lot of people have heard of the activity of workforce planning, which is what's my, you know, 6 to 18 month headcount strategy, where am I going to recruit from? And what people forget is I should look at the available staff that I have today. Have I optimized my workforce, my headcount that I have now, before I go and look at either headcount reduction or headcount recruitment? That's one fundamental difference, is that, again, time and attendance has not been seen as a strategic source of information, but now it is with the benefit of analytics. And secondly, you're driving home a very timely discussion with this FLSA change to exempts. The new rules around the Fair Labor Standards Act and the definition of who can be exempt based on their salary threshold, we're expecting an announcement from the White House in the next week or so that could drastically increase that minimum salary threshold from $23,000 approximately to in the area of $50,000 a year. So what that means is anybody making less than the new threshold, if it's $50,000 or $47,000, is now going to need to be hourly or given a salary increase. That's a huge opportunity for labor analytics. Am I going to have to lay people off because I can't afford to give a 30% increase to hundreds of people in my organization? Or are there other alternatives? If I turn them to hourly, how many overtime hours might they have now that they're eligible for overtime? So the Affordable Care Act made the 30-hour rule. And the point is, regulations, policies, unionization, the media around, for example, the scheduling and the flexibility and the predictability, all these forces are telling us we've got to manage the workforce more intelligently.
Lisa, we're actually running pretty close to the end of the half hour here. This has been great. Final question for me is, what has Deloitte learned through this whole process, using LaborWise, you know, being in these organizations? What surprised you?
I guess the lack of knowledge of what's going on behind the scenes, that there's so much undermanaged labor spending. And this has been an area that hasn't been studied. There are very few places you can go to get educated on workforce management, and that the magnitude of the problem was as consistently as large as what we're finding. When we started out and we found, you know, organizations with 2 or 3%, you know, it was easy to think that was an anomaly. But as we've been doing this more and more, it's almost like the unemployment rate. It just feels like there's a steady state of leakage everywhere. The analytics that we've been using are showing us that we can get at it. We can get at the root cause. This is the other thing. People have known these things happened for a long time, but they felt helpless. They really couldn't do anything until we could expose it with the data. And now that we're exposing the root cause, now we're getting into predicting it. So why are we having these things happen? Why are people doing these things? What scenarios, and how can I start to avoid those traps? I think those are the big surprises.
Great. Hey, for people in the audience, there are some good questions out there on the chat board. Lisa's going to join us in a couple of minutes on the chat. Lisa, I see a few here that you can touch base on. People asking about what's applicable here in terms of marketing and advertising divisions, a few other good points here. So I hope people will stick around, and we'll convert to the text chat. So as we wrap up here, I want to thank Lisa. This has been a great discussion, and I know that our audience members will have some key takeaways that can help them in their own situations. And I want to thank everyone for joining us, and thanks to our sponsor, SAS. This has been Jim Connolly for All Analytics Radio and UBM Tech. Thank you for tuning in, and Lisa, thank you for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
Enjoy the rest of your day.